The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 39 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, and I'll hold this show till hell freezes over, or you say different. Got a good show tonight, and I'll tell you about it in a second. First, I want to thank everybody who's put a nice review for the podcast on iTunes. We don't have a lot of reviews, and when I look at big popular podcasts and see hundreds and sometimes thousands of reviews and ratings, it makes my feel pretty slight. However, each individual review is nice, and they all say positive things, and I am very, very grateful for everybody who's taken the time to do this, and I urge you all to do it, to go to iTunes, to click on the ratings and review menu at the top of the Commentary Track page, and just say something nice about the show. This helps put us up in the ratings a little bit and makes more people aware of the show, and we hope that will make more people listen to the show. It seems logical to me, especially since everybody who's reviewed it has loved the show. And so I've got to figure that there are many, many people out there who also love the show who just have not done this. This is a way you can support the show without spending a penny, and I'm all for that, and I know that you are too. Because times are hard for most of us, and believe me, when you're making a podcast, the money ain't rolling in, so I'm as aware of that as anybody. So you don't have to spend any money to do this. Just go in there and write a few nice words and click on 5-star rating, if you think it's worth 5 stars, and I hope you do, and that'll really help. I'm going to read just one. I sometimes read a couple, but I'll just read the most recent one that came up. And this is just the most recent one, so it's not picked because it says nice things about me, because most of them say nice things. But it reads, this is by a listener named Lon Boris, or that is his screen name anyway. Or with a name like Lon Boris, perhaps it's Scream Name. I'm sorry, I did that. I'm really sorry. If I had any pride, I would edit that out. But his review reads, these podcasts are a pure pleasure. It's not just that Frank Thompson and his guests know so much about movies, it's the enthusiasm with which they engage each other, sharing knowledge and speculations in ways that pull you right in. If you've ever liked The Searchers, for example, you'll want to run back and watch it again to see what you missed after hearing Frank's sessions with Joseph McBride and Glenn Frankel. These guys just take off and take you right along with them. It's wonderful listening. Now see, that's short and sweet, and it says it all, and it's really positive. And I love hearing words like that. So thanks very much to Lon Boris. And thank you to all of you who, upon listening to this, are going to go straight to iTunes and leave me a good review. Now let's get on to today's podcast. And see how I alternate today and tonight, because who knows when you're going to be listening. As it happens, it's daytime when I record this. It's my birthday, in fact. Well, you want me to wait a while you all sing happy birthday? And I am recording this and waiting on my birthday cake, which at this point has not made its appearance. And I'm beginning to get a little antsy, I must tell you. Like my birthday cake. I perhaps like birthday cake too much. And why I've sometimes celebrated my birthday, sometimes up to 300 days a year. But this is my actual birthday, June 10th. And I'm recording it today and posting this podcast on my birthday. So I just like us all to celebrate because we're all friends here. It's like a big family. Actually, it's nothing like a family because we all like each other and we all get along. My guest today is Jordan Young. Jordan has been a friend of mine for many years. And in many ways, Jordan and I have lived parallel lives. We are both freelance writers, which is more than just being film historians, although both of us can also be called that. But freelance writers also just write for a living. And so Jordan, like me, has written many, many, many articles for magazines and newspapers. And now he's doing ebooks and He's publishing his own books in many different forms, and he's just a prolific writer and an awfully good writer. And so I not only have a great deal of affection for Jordan, because we have been good friends for a long time, I would say since the early 80s. I think we talk about that in the interview you're about to listen to. But I also have just the utmost respect for him as a writer. And I tell you, the people that he has interviewed is staggering. I've got to say, he is the only human I have ever met in my life, and probably likely the only one I ever will meet, who interviewed both Burt Mustin and John Lennon. So come on, is that range? I know you're going to like this interview with Jordan, and so sit back and listen, and we will see you on the other side. Movie buff from early childhood?
Age of six, actually, and it really begins the first day of first grade, because that's when I met my friend Elliot Bonin. He was the new kid in school. I think he was from Wisconsin originally. Anyway, he moves out here with his parents and starts school in Whittier. And because he was the new kid in school, the teacher, I can't imagine, I volunteered for it. She must have volunteered me as to show him around the school, as a result of which we became best friends, as a result of which I eventually became a raging, I say eventually, didn't take very long, became a huge fan of silent movies and the whole, what I call vintage entertainment or nostalgia entertainment, the whole realm, old-time radio, vaudeville, even though we couldn't see the actual vaudeville, of course. We were seeing it on TV in the 50s and in the radio, and it was still, you know, all those short subjects and things. There was a lot of sure. the vaudeville captured then, although we weren't seeing the Vitagraph, things that have now come to, which we would have, you know, I mean, maybe a couple of them were around, but we would have gone absolutely crazy to see those back in the 50s. But the earliest memory I have is that Elliot invited me over. I mean, I was over at his house all the time. We only lived a few blocks from each other in Whittier. And he had an 8mm projector, and he had some cut-down reels from Black Hawk. And the earliest thing that I can remember seeing is Easy Street with Charlie Chaplin, of course, and Eric Campbell. And we must have looked at some Keystone Cops. We couldn't have seen very much Buster Keaton because you couldn't see it then. We probably saw a cut-down of the film Cops. And we probably saw some Laurel and Hardy's. He must have had some cut-down Laurel and Hardy stuff. Eventually, I discovered that my dad was a big Shirley Temple fan and the Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan films. That was really what brought him out to California. My folks were both from Boston originally. But my dad had been out here briefly when he was in the Navy. And he was just, you know, the Shirley Temple movies, the Tarzan movies. And then discovered at some point that he was a big fan of movie character actors as well. But
he moved out here just because he liked movies or liked California?
Decided California, I mean, as opposed to shoveling snow in Boston, you know. That this was where they wanted to be when they moved out here in 49. And but anyway, Elliot's dad is a pretty strange duck. He had I know he had a sign in the front window of his house in Whittier that said, "Say Habla Yiddish," just to give you some idea. But anyway, he was the one who got Elliot interested in all this stuff. He claimed he knew Jolson, and he knew Lawrence Welk. And so
I was. What did his dad do?
He was a realtor, among other things. He was also a ham radio operator, which was an amazing thing in the 50s.
Sure.
Pre-internet and pre-everything else, you know, pretty amazing to me in those days. But as a result of this friendship, I became a huge fan of not only Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin, but of Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor and Jack Benny and Burns and Allen. I only lived a block from the school, the grade school that we attended. And just magically, I think it must have been Channel 5, KTLA, had Jack Benny on from 12 to 12:30 and Burns and Allen on from 12:30 to 1 or vice versa. And because I'm only a block away, I could get home every day. Not only do I get Mom's wonderful home-cooked lunch, I also get Jack Benny and Burns and Allen.
You
and
can't
go
beat
back
that.
To school, you know. That was that was my weekday, you know. So, and then going over to Elliot's house as often as possible to watch these 8mm cut downs of Black Hawk, but I was hooked on silent movies from the age of 6.
Wow. So you probably didn't know that many other kids in your class.
Oh, we were very strange kids. Yeah. I mean, this is the mid-50s, you know, middle and late 50s when it was before the nostalgia boom, before it was camp, before it was nostalgia, anything. So we were very strange kids. No, I didn't know anybody else until I got to junior high school. Then I met my friend Alan DeMare, who was introduced me to Spike Jonze. And a year or two later, and the way that he did that was he and his friend, who became my very good friend, Ken Stover, we moved to La Habra, and Ken and Alan drove up in my driveway with Der Fuhrer's Face blaring out of a, I think it might have been a 12-track tape or 8-track or 12-track or whatever, 8-track tape, I guess.
That's what 8-track, yeah.
Okay, I'm getting a little senile here, but... as we all do, but blaring out of a tape in their car, in any case, I mean, very loudly, you know, you could hear it from the upstairs bedroom window. That was my introduction to Spike Jonze.
Wow.
When I was about 13. But anyway, in junior high, just a few years before that, Alan got me interested in photography. He was the first person I know who went and saw The Producers. Of course, that's some years later, but was just raving about how great that was when nobody had seen it. You know, he had seen it, of course, and that kind of a person who came up one day with a copy of something called Screen Thrills Illustrated, with this wonderful magazine that didn't last very long, but had all these articles about these old movies and. From the 30s and 40s, and I have to show you, I still have some of them. But so anyway, I'm just going to say the Golden Age of Comedy came out, you know, when I was about 8 or 9, I saw it, and I didn't see it in the theater. I remember seeing it. They would bring the 16mm prints to the school, to the grade school. They would, 6 months after they were shown in theaters, they were... The school was running 16mm prints of everything, of the Jerry Lewis films and that I did see in theaters, but also they were bringing those on 16mm 6 months or a year later. But that was where I saw the Golden Age comedy the first time. But I was already familiar. When the title, The Bow and the Fiddle, came up on the screen, I knew who it was, you know.
Wow.
So I had already seen Chaplin and Laurel Hardy, at least by that point, and I say the Keystone Cops and some of the other Senate stuff, you know. But... it was introduced me to, I'm sure that was probably the first time I'd seen Harry Lang then and a lot of other people, you know. Harold Lloyd.
Sure. Now, how long did it take you to start actually researching film and really thinking about it seriously like that?
I think by the time I got out of high school, I was pretty, the very first article that I ever published with my byline was when I was about 15. In the high school paper, I was taking journalism. I wasn't allowed to take journalism until my sophomore year. But I think it was in my sophomore year before I ever started writing for the school paper that I knew the editor, and so he ran a story that I had, and it was on silent film comedians. So I haven't gone very far. I'm still writing about silent film comedians.
That's as far as you need to go.
Yeah, that was the very first article when I was 15. I know that I was planning, when I was in high school, I was planning to write a book called The Rise and Fall of Comedy. I think that was the title. And at that point, you know, there weren't any books really, nothing had been written, 64, 65, nothing had really, you know, existed. And I didn't know about any of the great libraries or anything at that point. So I can't imagine what the research consisted of. There was obviously, there was no internet, but it was, I would say it was the Wikipedia level of, you know, and I don't have much respect for that. Because anybody can, a literate 5-year-old can contribute to that thing. Sure.
And they do.
And people believe it, you know, it may be accurate. It may be horse feathers, you know, but I would say it was probably on that level when I was 14 or 15, as you'd expect, but it didn't take very long to start getting, in junior college, I was writing again for the paper. And at this, by this point, by age 17, 18, 19, I'm writing not a lot of them, but I started to write fan letters. I had written a piece on George Burns for the local paper when I was about 18, and I sent it to him. And he sent me back a very nice letter saying, you may have found your future, and so forth and so on. The first interview I conducted for the Fullerton College newspaper was on Burt Mustin, this character actor.
Sure.
And I had exchanged letters. I had written him a fan letter, and he wrote me back a 3-page handwritten letter. So then I think I brought it in and showed it to the entertainment editor of the college paper. And he said, why don't you interview him? That hadn't occurred to me. So I went out to Hollywood and interviewed him. I just drove up the freeway and interviewed him and became very good friends with him. And would go when he was taping a show. I would go and watch the taping and things. I went and go to the Maskers Club. Hmm. The Maskers Club was it existed since the 20s or 30s, and a lot of well-known people like Charlie Chase were members of the Maskers. But I would. At Burt Mustin's invitation, I would go and hang out there with him and watch him play cards with his pals. But I got to meet Percy Helton once. I wanted to interview him, and I saw him in a play there, and he died just a few months later, early 70s. And there were a lot of people I met in the early 70s, like Mantan Moreland, that I didn't get the chance to interview. But
all those people through the Maskers Club.
Not Mantan, but Percy Helton and Frank Phelan and I think Nathaniel Finston. You see his name a lot as the orchestrator or the conductor on a lot of old films. And Jack Mulhall, silent film
amazing,
player.
Yeah.
And a lot of other people, too. Yeah.
Now, tell me about Burt Mustin, because... I remember when I was a kid, he was on TV all the time.
You name the show, and he was on it.
But it seems like he was either born 70 years old, or he just didn't start working until he was 70 years old.
I have pictures of him from Pennsylvania Military College circa 1902, 1903, and he's easily recognizable, but he has a full head of hair.
Well.
His secret really was that he... He worked in all these other trades, you know, selling automobiles, I guess, or selling medical equipment at some point, and various trades. But his hobby was acting and singing and dancing in community theater and things like that. And he was on the radio back in the 20s, just part of a group that was singing commercials for automobiles and things like that. So by the time that he got the opportunity, circa 1950, to appear in a film, he was living out in Tucson then, in retirement, I guess. And I think it was the last outpost with Ronald Reagan. They were shooting, and they came through town, and they put out the call for anybody who could ride a horse or something like that. Yeah, years later, he got a job. It was a picture called Dirty Dingus McGee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they hired him sight unseen. I don't know what the deal was, whether he was a replacement or something, but they flew him out to the location. And then he got there, and they said, you're our Indian scout. And he said, well, that's fine. There's just two things. I'm 86, and I don't ride a horse. You know, it went, at that point, one fall, and he'd be finished. But that was his beginning, was on The Last Outpost, if that's the title, with Ronald Reagan. I know he did Cattle Queen of Montana with him a few years later. He did the detective story with Kirk Douglas after that. That's his official first film. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to have a credit before their official first credit. You know, even Elisha Cook. He's doing Broadway plays and off-Broadway plays, and he did a Broadway play called Her Unborn Child, and somebody made wasn't a home movie, and I've certainly never seen it, but it must have been some real low-budget film production of it, you know, that has apparently vanished, and that's his first credit about 4 years before he comes to Hollywood. Wow. First film credit.
Now we must find that.
We must find Her Unborn Child with Elisha Cook. So if you're out there and you know where it is or you have a copy in your basement, by all means, give Frank Thompson a call.
I'll make a documentary about it.
You probably will. And anyway, Burt Mustin is in every single TV show from the 50s, 60s, and 70s that you can name. I remember him best from Leave It to Beaver.
Sure, me too.
And it's really funny, just at the recent, it's not that funny, but it was, I got a kick out of, when I was at the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival a few weeks ago, running into Tony Dow in just a little pizza parlor in the Hollywood and Highland complex. He was with some friends, and they started talking to me about the arts blog that I do, and she said, turned out to be a publicist friend of his from New York, but she said, "You want to interview a sculptor?" And she pointed to him and told me who he was, and I had just said hello to him a second earlier walking in the place because there's nobody else in there, and didn't recognize him.
Wow.
But anyway, I remember Burt best from that show. But from so many other shows that were on at that time, and eventually wrote him that fan letter, you know, some years later.
Well, you started specializing in character actors right off the bat. Was that just because they were more interesting to you, or they were more accessible to you?
Well, they're, you know, certainly easier to get interviews with them than the stars, but more interesting, really. I've just always found them more interesting. They hold the movie together. I mean, they're the glue. You know, you see so many. I can't say that I've seen tons of bad movies from the 30s, but if you add them up, there are quite a number of films from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s that aren't all that great. But if you have Edward Everett Horton or Franklin Pangborn or Grady Sutton or Elisha Cook or John Quaylen or you know, Charles Lane in them. And between them, they must be in every single picture ever made.
Oh, sure.
Certainly guys like Charles Lane and George Chandler you see on Turner Classic Movies almost every single day.
Throw in Frank McEwen, you got every movie.
Yeah. 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 If Chandler is in it, then Frank McHugh is in it. I wish I had interviewed him. I do have an autographed picture that I sent a picture out to Cos Cob, Connecticut, and Cos Cob Con, and he's autographed it and sent it back.
Well, I was talking about this with somebody just recently about how it seems like the term character actor now means a different thing than it used to mean, and now when you'll often hear a star like Dustin Hoffman or somebody say that he's a character actor. And what he means by that is that he tries to be a different kind of person every time he's in a movie and takes on a different persona and all that, which I contend is the opposite of what the character actors did, which was to build a personality that was instantly recognizable.
They were hired for a specific type.
To be a very specific thing.
Yeah.
So Franklin Pangborn, it's not that every part he did was identical, but he was very definitely played within a type, and it was Franklin Pangborn, immediately recognizable when he comes onto the screen. You know what he's going to be like. You know what his gestures are going to be like. And so it seems like it's the definition of character actor has morphed over the years. Do you agree with that?
Largely, I would agree with it. But, you know, I mean, movies have changed. There aren't any jobs anymore. Sure. For, I mean, Pangborn isn't around anymore. Eric Bloor isn't around anymore. But there aren't any jobs for those guys anyway. You know, even if they were here today, they'd be starving because, you know, there's so little. They seem only to have time for the leads. There's very seldom even. There's usually a best friend or a second lead, a co-starring role. But beyond that, there's almost nothing. There are very seldom any little bits, you know.
But even the best friend is going to be cast with somebody who's going to be a lead in the next picture.
Yeah, probably. It's going to be, it's. But there are so few roles for that type of... that's the great thing about those movies from that era, from the golden era, so-called golden era, is that they had time to do this. They had time for Eric Bloor. I mean, it's one of the... I never get tired of watching him. He doesn't seem to repeat himself to me. I mean, he finds, even just within that tight little niche that they would cast him for, and of course Top Hat is probably the prime example, but, you know, even a second-rate film like, is it Breakfast for Two with Barbara Stanwyck and Herbert Marshall? It's not what I would call a great movie, but Eric Bloor makes it an absolute must-see for any fan of, you know, he's absolutely hysterical in that picture.
Yeah. And Warner Brothers pictures from the 30s is going to be a cavalcade of character actors. You're going to have, you know, Cagney and Blondell in the lead, and then everybody else in the picture is going to be somebody you know.
Yeah. Frank McHugh, of course, but also so many other wonderful
people. Aileen McMahon and all those people. They just
I saw her as Eddie Cantor's grandmother in the Eddie Cantor story.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's Eddie Cantor's grandmother. I saw that long before it was unbelievable to me when I started seeing her in pictures like 42nd Street or she's in all those things, so tell me, quote me into which one that she's in, but she's in almost all of them.
Sure.
But, yeah. Guy Kibbe, of course, and Ned Sparks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he was a carnival barker. I found that out. That was absolutely delightful to me. You can really see it in his, you know...
I never knew that, but I'm delighted to know it.
I'm pretty sure I'm not misquoting that. I may not... I may tell you a few lies today, but that's what we're here for anyways, to tell lies.
I can see into it. Alive on the inside.
It's that wonderful sour puss, like nobody else. I mean, there were other people who tried to do that. I mean, I would say Oscar Levant was a wonderful, you know, talent for, you know, just on in his own right, but he's sort of a watered-down Ned Sparks, you know.
He tried to be curmudgeonly, but it never really came off that well.
Yeah, nobody pulled it off as well as Ned Sparks. And he makes those pictures for me.
Sure.
Even if, you know, all the wonderful singing and dancing is going on the...
Oh, anything. I mean, Gold Diggers in 1933, it's like everybody in the frame is somebody great. You know, it's just something... It's
somebody terrific. How do you top the Pig Latin number with Ginger Rogers? And they actually, there was a recent musical where they did that on the stage and did it very well. But that might be my favorite Warner Brothers musical. I don't think 42nd Street holds up quite as well. Maybe that's sacrilege.
Well,
but
you know, I like 42nd Street a lot, but I will agree that Gold Diggers of 33 is great.
And what other film has, you know, the Brotherhood of Man, you know, is that the,
Well, the... remember My Forgotten Man.
My Forgotten Man. Yeah. I always misquote that, My Forgotten Man. But that's the most extraordinary thing because it's so unusual and so strange. You know, it's just...
It's a light comedy throughout the entire film, and then it ends on this...
Yeah.
This dark depression.
One thing which I have to say about Turner Classic Movies, and it is my... As I said to you during lunch, it is my drug of choice. Yeah. I just mainline it. But a lot of people that I had seen but never really paid much attention to, I was paying too much attention to Franklin Pangborn and Edward Everett Horton to notice so many of these people that I watch them on the, I mean, I've sort of rediscovered Barbara Stanwyck. Mm. I love her. I just can't get enough of her.
Yeah.
She might be the greatest actress of that era, you know.
I'm not going to argue with you there.
I mean, she, you know.
No, she's great, and she starts off great. I mean, her persona develops and morphs over the years, but at every stage of the way, it's something really fascinating, really interesting.
And Elisha Cook was actually kind of made me aware of that in a funny way. I interviewed him a couple of times. Most people I got to interview only once. But Elisha Cook, I hung out with him on a couple of movie sets. And the first interview was in his agent's office in L.A. But the second interview, I got an assignment from the New York Times to interview him. And I called him up. He lived in Bishop. And he had a campsite near Lake Sabrina in the Sierras. And he had had it since the 40s, maybe. He lived up there since the 40s. He would just drive down here whenever he had a job. But he got that far away from, he, you know, from Hollywood. Yeah. That's the only way that he could. And his pals like Gary Cooper and Lon Chaney Jr. would go hunting and fishing with him up there. But he invited me to go camping with him. I think it was a 4th of July weekend.
Wow.
And this is one of my great experiences. He got roaring drunk the first night. He didn't touch a forkful of the food of this wonderful dinner that his wife had cooked and sent up there with us. But the next morning, it's very early in the morning, and I'm waking up, and I hear somebody puttering around out there. And well, we had a few people with us, camping with us on that trip, but I got up to see if it was him, and sure enough, he's out there making coffee or something. We get a little fire, and I went out there and started to chat with him, and he was cold sober, and so I went and with his permission, went and got my tape recorder. But it was funny because he knew I had heard all the stories. He was a great storyteller, but you know, it was one of those guys that had been interviewed a lot, and so he would tell the same stories about Bogart and about Marilyn Monroe. And other people that he had worked with. And so he knew, at this point, he knew I had heard all those stories. But it was dead quiet out there. There was nobody else up. It's like, I don't know, 6 in the morning or something. And I rose to the occasion. I think, unusually introspective. You know, he didn't often, from what I can tell from all the interviews I've looked at and hanging out with him on, like I say, on movie sets and things, I asked him who influenced him, who inspired him at the beginning, but he told me he had seen Barbara Stanwyck in a Broadway show. This is before she came to Hollywood, maybe late 20s. And she had a scene in this. They were electrocuting. They were, I guess, giving her husband the electric chair in this play, and she had a scene where she was arranging with the governor for her to have the body afterwards, and he said he was absolutely revulsed by this. She was, I mean, it's literally almost quoted to quote Elisha. He said she was so great that she made him vomit, that he had to be bolted up out of his chair in the theater and ran down to the basement to the men's room and vomited. She was so great. She had such impact on him.
Wow.
And he said that she was the biggest influence on him. Wow. Of anyone. You would never expect that Barbara Stanwyck would be, you know.
No, not the greatest influence on Elisha Cook Jr.
No.
and I can't think of a performance that's ever made me throw up because it's so great.
No.
I've had more than one affect me that way for other reasons.
I wouldn't say he got a bum rap in films, but you know, I don't think Hollywood ever really got him. I mean, he was, of course, I mean, once he was typecast, once he did the Maltese Falcon.
Sure.
If you get a chance to see the pictures he did before that, he's playing all kinds of parts.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites, I would say my favorite performance of his that I've seen prior to The Maltese Falcon is maybe his second or third picture is Pigskin Parade with Judy Garland.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of hers. It's not her first picture. Was it her second picture?
It's
something
close
like that.
To her first,
you know,
yeah.
Close to her first picture, yeah. And it's close to his first picture, too. And he's playing a... he's not a college student, but he's playing a... they get him to play this college radical as the... gets very agitated in this one scene. It's so unlike anything else that I've ever seen him do. But he's usually playing jockeys, Tin Pan Alley. He plays a song plugger or something, or a pianist. He's playing a lot of just very strange parts, you know. But that part, he really gets a chance to... but he was I don't know how big a name he was, but he was a recognized stage actor. Eugene O'Neill picked him to play the young O'Neill in Wilderness and came backstage at opening night or something and gave him this wonderful, you know, note and praise, you know, that capturing the sense of, you know.
That's something I didn't know. That's amazing.
Yeah, but they bring him out here, and they were going to put him in Lives of a Bengal Lancer, I think, and he had a contract. He couldn't do it. He had to get back to, he had like 6 weeks, and then he had to get back to New York. Oh, didn't happen.
Yeah, you wonder how many of those people who ended up being character actors just missed, I mean, it's almost just like a little misconnection that they might have gone into leading parts, or they... You know, just it could have gone either way.
I think most of them, it was their looks. You know, they had they had a particular look or something, which, of course, would have kept the Dustin Hoffmans from you know, getting
sure.
He just that era, you know, where he came in, everything changes. You know, it's where suddenly they're making stars out of all the character actors, even people like, you know, Charles Durning eventually becoming a star, and so many others that partly because they cut out or stopped writing parts for the character people. And
and I can remember when Dustin Hoffman first came on the scene that there was a lot written and talked about that, you know, this is a leading man.
Yeah, he didn't look like a leading man, you know. And, yeah.
Now you don't think twice about it, but it's, at the time it seemed odd.
I've never interviewed Dustin Hoffman. I did interview Donald Sutherland for the New York Times.
Same thing. If anything, he was even funnier looking when he was younger than...
Yeah, and of course he did play character parts when he started out. It's incredible that he has been on the screen over 50 years. He is, I don't know, some staggering number of films because he's working constantly. He did play a lot of character parts starting out, but at the time when I interviewed him in the late 70s, he was trying to refashion himself as a leading man. It was a very short period of his career, and I guess either he or his agent or somebody thought, Dustin Hoffman can do it, Robert Duvall can do it, all these other guys, you know, so why not Sutherland, you know? So he had a very short period for a couple of years where they tried to refashion him as leading man, which didn't last very long. It failed, and he went back to playing character parts, which he's so brilliant at, I think. I mean, he's, you know, he gives a wonderful performance in Ordinary People, which is right at the height of that, is probably his best leading man type, you know, performance opposite Mary Tyler Moore. But he's, you know, I mean, he's really outstanding.
I mean, he's the epitome of what character actor means now, I think, because you take his part in Ordinary People, you look at his part in MASH, you look at his part in Dirty Dozen, and they're like three completely different people.
Yeah.
They look kind of the same in a way, but other than their looks, because they're the same guy, the characters and everything else are completely different. So he's one of those guys who really does kind of submerge himself into the part that he's playing, and to whatever extent he just disappears into it and becomes something else, which is not what you say about Ned Sparks or Eugene Paulette or people like that.
Right.
They were doing something else.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, the actors were more have more opportunity today to do that. I mean, they didn't allow them to do. They didn't allow the leading people either to the leads.
Sure.
Were typecast, of course. Were much like the character people. They were typecast and pretty much made to do the same type of part over and over again, and very seldom got to do anything else.
And I think in some ways it's led to this weird thing that I don't think a lot of those actors get the respect that they deserve for being how good they are, because you think of them as their type. Cagney, Edward G. Robinson.
Right, right.
I'd say John Wayne, Bette Davis. These are all people who had such vivid on-screen personas that there are still people who think, oh, that's just Bette Davis. She's just being Bette Davis.
It took Edward G. Robinson a long time. Here was another. He was an established stage actor in Yiddish theater.
Yeah.
And he was doing silent pictures. I've never seen any of them, but he did some silent pictures.
I've seen one.
Yeah. And... bang, he does Little Caesar, and he's typecast as a gangster, which is so unfair.
Yeah.
And it really isn't until the 40s that he really comes into his own, I think. And here's somebody who did get an opportunity to break out of the mold that they tried to type him in.
Yeah.
But it took a long time, and it took some brilliant directors like Billy Wilder to see that. I think that is his best performance, is in Double Indemnity as the insurance investigator.
Sure.
He's absolutely brilliant in it. But it took a Billy Wilder, and it took, you know, our Vines of Tender Grapes, mm-hmm. Another one where they allowed him to do something completely against type, as the father of Margaret O'Brien.
Yeah.
Wonderful picture.
Yeah, it's a real, real warm performance.
But he's actually, if you think about it, he's one of the few leading actors of that era who got a chance to break out of the, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you think of another tragedy, I think, in one way, I mean, is Boris Karloff. Because who got typed more than he did? And yet, whenever you get to see glimpses of the wit that he had and this gentle humor that he had and all these different things that he could have played. He could have been a C. Aubrey Smith type. He could have been any number of kinds of characters.
Yeah.
And
it was a guy that just really got...
he got slammed hard. And
he did. And Lugosi, of course, Lugosi, the same thing.
And,
you know?
And it destroyed Lugosi. Cause
he did.
He couldn't cope with it.
No.
And that's, you know, that's very, really too bad.
I really like him as Igor in Son of Frankenstein. But in a sense, it's another, you know.
Yeah.
But
I think that's, you know, he comes over here from being this matinee idol in his homeland.
Yeah.
And playing this great part. And then he plays it in the movie here and doesn't realize that that has sealed his fate. And he never got out of it.
Yeah, when he gets it, he thinks, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. And then it destroys him. And he's unrecognizable in Annochka, of course, but it's such a quick scene, you know.
Yeah.
And unless you know it's Lugosi, you don't...
You almost don't register in a way.
I just saw it again recently, and I had to take a second look at it. Oh, my God. Because I hadn't seen it in years.
And when he's got a good director and a good picture and everything, he's terrific. And you can see that he's got the goods. But and then there are people like George Raft, who, of course, seems to have sabotaged his own career just by inexplicably turning down every great movie that was ever made. It seemed like they would offer it to George Raft first, and he was like, Casablanca? No, it doesn't seem like a good picture to me. So,
Or Georgie Jessel, the same.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, Jessel did The Jazz Singer on Broadway,
sure.
Of course. And Sam Jaffe told me that he was supposed to have done the film. That Jaffe had done the play with Jessel, and he was supposed to do the film. And Jessel asked for so much money that he killed it for both of them.
Was Jaffe playing his father?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe so.
They had to be the same age, or Jaffe might have been even younger than Jessel, were they? Well, there
you
go.
Yeah, Jaffe was an interesting. I got to know him fairly well. I didn't see, you know. He enjoyed talking about almost everything except Sam Jaffe.
Mm.
But he was just a hugely, I mean, just the intelligence of that guy, you know. He could talk about art and music and politics and all of these and philosophy. And we did because I would go up there and hang out with him in Beverly Hills and he really wasn't interested in talking about Sam Jaffe on and on and on.
Did you get a good interview with him about his career?
Well, I did. The first one was for the LA Times, and I interviewed a lot of character actors for them, and so that was for the Times, and he understood at least the first time out that that was what I needed to talk about, and yeah, there were people that were very reluctant to John Quayle, and it was one of the really reluctant ones. He'd retired by then. And he just wasn't interested. And he just wanted to, he moved out to Torrance, and we just wanted to forget the whole thing. And I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back a nice note, you know, thanks, but I don't need the publicity. And then I wrote him again a few years later, and then I think I took a third try one time. I really like to meet this guy. I really just love his work, and of course, The Grapes of Wrath.
Sure,
but and that was by far the best opportunity he ever got. He tended to be typecast again as, you know, as Swedish characters, as characters with a Swedish dialect. It's just very unfair, you know. But in that one, Ford gives him the opportunity to get a little bit beyond that, and
I submit that His Girl Friday is a shining moment for him too,
of course, and the same year, no less. Yeah, right. Almost
because he gives a really great, very small performance. I mean, it's a real interior performance.
It is, beautiful. yeah, really a beauty. And anyway, the third letter did the trick. I get a letter back from him, a little handwritten, hand typed note back from him, and this funny little stationery, this little pad of paper, whatever. And the third time, what I did was, instead of asking him for an interview, I simply said I would like to take him to lunch.
Mm.
And he wrote me back and said that he would, whatever, be happy to have lunch with me or something. And he said, if you're out this way, give us a call or something. And so the very next day, I had to go to Torrance. Just magically, I just...
What a coincidence.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Yeah. Called him up and said, you know, I'm going to be out in Torrance. And he said, okay. And I took John and his wife to lunch. And at the, I think Black Angus was where he wanted to go. I was not the kind of place where I'd go for lunch, but that was what he wanted to. I said, fine. And then he wouldn't let me pick up the check. And in fact, a very funny experience that comes to mind. I was having lunch with Jester Hairston one day, and we got to be very good friends. But we were having lunch at a restaurant in Beverly Hills, and I already knew from, you know, having lunch or dinner with him a few times before that it wasn't going to be easy to pick up the check. And so I distracted him. In fact, I think when we walked in, I told the waiter or waitress, do not under any circumstances, you know, bring it to me. And anyway, I managed to somehow to distract him when she brought the bill. And he lunged across the table and ripped it out of my hand. I've never seen anybody so forcefully, you know. He was just adamant, you know, that he just ripped it out of my hand. and was very upset that I
wow.
would even consider paying the bill. It would not allow him to pick up the check. But anyway, John Quaylen, it wasn't an interview, and so he felt free to just talk about his career. And I don't know whether I started asking him questions or whether he just started telling me stories, or he's telling me all these great stories. And so I just I started scribbling on the I didn't bring a notebook or a tape recorder because it's not supposed to be an interview. And I just started scribbling on the paper placemat and everything. And whether he asked me if I wanted some paper or I end up back in their living room and he's telling me, we were talking about the Grapes of Wrath, and he demonstrates for me how he could just turn the tears on and off like a faucet. He did the whole scene for me.
Wow.
In the living room. And it was even better than on the film. I mean, this is really an extraordinary moment, was just watching him. And it was so, he made it more real than it is in the film, even. And then he just turned the tears off like a faucet, you know.
It's the scene about what makes land yours. I mean, that
yeah,
scene.
When they're taking the land away from him. Yeah, his monologue, his great moment in the film, you know. But it was even better in the living room.
Wow.
And yeah, I know it's acting. I know it. You know, it's artifice at its, you know, at its core. And yet, to watch him just turn it off like that, like one second he's the character, and the next second he's John Quayle just telling the story about
wow.
it. And, yeah, I could just turn the tears off like that, banging. Like, whoa. Hey, that was a really great moment in your research for Real Characters, which is the book, of course, that eventually came out of all those interviews. And it was really the editor at the LA Times, Irv Latofsky, God bless him, who gave me those assignments to do all those, most of those pieces.
Yeah.
And then who suggested one day the book to me that I should...
Now, when did Real Characters get published?
Oh, that would have been, I think, 1984. No, 86, I think. 86, huh. Yeah.
Because my chronology has gone all kerflooey on that. Because I'm trying to think of when you and I met.
I'm
and
thinking
it had to be like 81.
I'm thinking it was 81 when, no, maybe we had already met prior to the it was the National Film Society panel, of course. Was it the Sheraton?
Well, we had to have met before. Because didn't you work with me on getting those people together?
Yeah, because Rolf Sedan was on that panel.
Yeah.
I know it was 81 because he passed in 82.
Yeah.
But I got you Rolf Sedan for that panel. Of course, Iris Adrian
yeah.
and Doodles Weaver, you got them.
Exactly.
And it wasn't Emil Sitko, it was that other guy.
A fake guy, a guy that nobody ever heard
yeah,
of.
Yeah, George and, Bob Kerr.
But, yeah, he showed up.
Yeah, and he ended up replacing Emil Sitka.
Yeah, and the people at the National Film Society came to me and said, oh, we've got this character actor. He's come to, you know, luckily he's here and he can be on your panel.
Yeah, Donald Bupka or something like that. Or
it was George something.
George
like
Bupka.
A Greek
name. Yeah.
But I'd never heard of him. I've never heard of him.
No, same here.
And
never heard of him, never seen him in a picture. I don't know who he was. Or I guess he was a guy I would like to have been a character actor or something, or somebody who did a bit on TV or something once. Or it was a real
But then we did another one, and I think
the
you
year
must
later.
Have helped me with that, with Fritz Feld and Virginia Christine.
I
you put that together. You emceed that.
Yeah, I put it together and emceed it.
George
Mike Mazursky, and I had now Virginia Christina Fritz Feld were friends by that point. I'd interviewed Fritz and been at their house many times. And I feel like Randy Skretbud sort of stole all my stories, but Virginia did make a great cup of coffee as Randy.
Yeah, it's been a long time since Randy's episode aired.
Yeah.
We could
well, and I got to enjoy that cup of coffee on many, but the story actually that he didn't tell was that Virginia, of course, had done these commercials, these Mrs. Olson commercials for Folgers, But I asked her one day about product, about getting, I assume that they giving a product or something, and she said, actually not. Not until one day when she said, you know, I'm just like any other frugal housewife. I'm going to go on the market and buy whatever's on sale. And I thought, oh, my God, what a public relations nightmare to have Mrs. Olson, you know. Yes,
buying Sanka. Yes.
Yeah. And at that point, she started getting all the product that she could, that they could consume. But but anyway, so Fritz and Virginia and Anita Garvin.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Dear Anita Garvin was also a great friend of mine. And then Mike Mazursky, I had never met. He was the one I didn't know. Maybe you got him.
Yeah.
And he was late. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get a chance to talk to him before, to go over my intro with him, because he walked in late. And maybe he walked in just as I was introducing him, or was standing on the in the back of the room or something, and I introduced him, and he at least what I had read was that he was Russian, and I made some lame joke about Russian fingers and Roman hands or something, and he corrected me, Ukrainian. Yes. And that was, even though my grandfather was from a village near Shtetl, a village near Kiev. And I had always heard growing up that he was Russian. Well, he was Ukrainian. Mm. But Mike Mazursky was the first person ever to put me onto the fact that there was a difference between Russian and Ukrainian. And I've been to the Ukrainian Art Museum in New York City and things. But
I might have gotten to Mazursky through Charlie Barton.
Oh, okay.
Because the night after that, we went over to Charlie's house in Toluca Lake, and Mike and Sylvia Mazursky came over, and we showed a movie, and maybe the Lindberghs were there. Maybe Greg and Jeff Lindberg were there as well. And so that was a fun night, just sitting around with, listening to Mazursky and Charlie Barton swap Hollywood stories.
And I feel really left out that I'd never met Charlie Barton, all these great stories.
Possible?
I don't know. Randy tells all these great stories about him, and I never met him, though.
I loved him to death. I only knew him for about 2 years. I met him just too late to develop a long. But every time I was in L.A., I had to stay at their house, and he was just one of those. He was just salt of the earth, and great storyteller. He was one of the best there ever was.
I think. So. Well, I like I said, I feel like I missed the boat there, but I got to know a lot of other people that
you sure did.
Very few other people got to meet, like George Marshall.
Yeah, now as you know, anybody who's listened to this podcast more than once, and I can't imagine who that would be, but if anybody has, I bring up George Marshall all the time, and it's because he's the epitome to me of one of the great directors who apparently has no cachet among film historians or film scholars. And I think it's one of those things that it's because, kind of like, there are several who fall into that category, but just do great quality work, but don't necessarily have that personal stamp like Hitchcock or Hawks.
Yeah, well, he did everything, though. He didn't just do murder mysteries, or he didn't just do comedies. He didn't just do westerns. He did comedies and westerns predominantly, but he did everything.
He did everything.
And like Michael Curtiz.
Like Michael Curtiz.
Exactly. he did absolutely everything, but it's true that he didn't direct Martin Lewis's best pictures or Jerry Lewis's best solo efforts, but and yet he directed three pictures with Laurel and Hardy, some of their best work. Destry Rides Again, of course,
great,
Murder, yeah. He Says, and a number of other films.
I'm a big fan of Houdini as well. It's like one of the most morbid pictures ever made.
Yeah,
but tell me how you met him.
I was at Goldwyn Studios in Hollywood one day. I was probably trying to get some publicity stills. And I'm standing there talking to the receptionist, and this old guy walks in, And I said, "Is that George Marshall?" And she says, "Yeah." And he had an office there. This is 1974. And I think by that time he'd retired, was no longer directing television, and had been about 5 years since the last feature film for Jerry Lewis that he directed. So I was very surprised that he, and either she put me through to him, or I met him in the lobby at that moment, or else she put me through to him when he walked back to his office, or I called him the next day on the phone. But I requested an interview, and like so many other people in the business, he said, "I'm saving it for my book. I'm writing my own book. You know, I'm not interested in talking to you, kid." You know, and
that's another recurring theme on this podcast. Yes.
Yeah,
go ahead.
But I don't know if it was the first conversation. It was probably the first conversation I had with George Marshall. I said, "Well, what if we just talked about Laurel and Hardy and nothing else? What if we just..." If that was the exclusive subject of the interview. And he said, okay. He agreed. But the catch was, I had to pin him down to, and he, I don't know whether he was deliberately trying to dodge me or whether he changed his mind, you know, and changed his mind or didn't really want to do it. That's a good possibility. Or he was just that kind of a guy, you know, maybe it had nothing to do with that, but he would say, "Call me at the end of the week and we'll set something up." You call him at the end of the week and he says, "Call me at the beginning of the week." "Call me at the beginning of next week." You call him on Monday and he says, "Call me at the end of the week." This went on for weeks and weeks, just to almost the point where I'm almost ready to throw in the towel, and he says, "Call me on Thursday. Let's do it Thursday at 2:00, but call me first." So I didn't do that. I went into Hollywood on Thursday and ran errands. I went to the library probably, or I ran other errands. I wasn't doing stuff for the LA Times yet, but I was doing research and had little projects and things and was running errands. And at 2:05, I was 5 minutes from Goldwyn Studios. So in those days when they still had telephone booths, before we all had cell phones, it would take 5 minutes just to find a phone and park. And sure. So I just drove over there, and he wasn't there. So I just planted myself in the lobby. And it was about 3:00 when he walked in. And he said, "Oh, good, you're here. Let's go." As it, you know, just completely ignoring the fact that he was an hour late. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I had stayed home and made the phone call, I would never have gotten the interview. He was dead like 5 months later, to the day.
Wow.
To the day. And so that was one, you know, sometimes you just have to outwit the interviewee. You have to, you know, you have to be just incredibly...
I'm actually going through that now with two people for the podcast who I will not name because they will be on, but they both have been for months. "Hey, give me a call at the end of the week and we'll set something up."
Well,
next week we should be fine,
we've been trying to get together for quite a while, and that's been my fault.
Yeah, but it's been yours. That's different. But
anyway, I outwitted him. We went back to his office, and we sat there and we talked about Laurel and Hardy for a good hour or hour and a half, and I just got extraordinary material. I really got gold. He didn't hold back anything from me. And he really opened up, and I don't think anyone else ever interviewed him on that subject. And, I wish he had written the book. I have looked. I have not contacted the family. The Directors Guild did have a lead to family members, but I have checked with the Guild and with the Academy and with the... I think it's Wisconsin has a collection. Hmm. Nobody has the book.
So, as far as you know, he never.
I have not talked to the kids, but as far as I know, he never wrote it. But
this does lead me to a good update of something that we talked about at lunchtime. Now, was it on my interview with Randy Skredvat, did we talk about George Chandler? Was I whining about the George Chandler story there?
It was one of them. Yeah, it was either that or another one.
And I might have brought it up a couple of times because it comes up, and I think about it a lot. But let me give some backstory to the listener, and then you can give me this update that I just got. And this is that when I was writing my book on William Wellman, George Chandler was in many of Wellman's films, 30-plus Wellman films.
Maybe 37, 38 films. Yeah.
And plus he was in a zillion other movies. And so my first trip to Los Angeles, I made it a point to go see George Chandler because he seemed to be one of the main people to talk to who was still alive at that time. And I went over to his house. He was very warm, very friendly, very welcoming, gave me a cup of tea, and then told me he was writing his own book and consequently was not going to tell me anything. And so the entire time we were there with my wife, and the entire time I would ask him a story about Nothing Sacred, and he would say, "Oh, that's a great story. It's in my book." And I'd ask him about something else. He'd say, "Oh, man, you won't believe that one. It's in my book." And so I did not beat him with a mallet. I simply politely left. And then he died and no book.
What year was that?
1979.
Okay. Because I interviewed him in 1978.
Yeah.
But I just had this experience with somebody a few years ago in New York. I find this guy through the Musicians Union, and what's interesting about musicians is they belong to the union forever. They pay their dues until they die.
Wow.
Because they have benefits. They get benefits, so even long after they've stopped blowing their horn or whatever it is, they belong to the union, and you can find them. And it was very useful information to me once I figured that out, sort of cracked the code to get a hold of all these guys who work for Spike Jones. But I found this guy through the union. He lived out in Levittown. And don't ask me where it is. I just got there on the train. But this guy had worked not for Spike, but for some obscure little comedy band back in the 30s. I think the name was Criss Cross, the name of the band. No relationship to the latter-day Christopher Cross. So I take the train out there, and his son or son-in-law picks me up at the train station, takes me to the house. I sit down and start talking to the guy, and he won't tell me anything. He just clams up. And I think the son was son-in-law was nearby, and I said to him, "What the hell is this?" You know, or maybe it was, I knew I had the train schedule, since there wasn't a train every few minutes. I had the schedule, and after about 20 or 30 minutes, I just gave up on the guy, and the son took me back to the train station, and I said to him, "What the hell is this?" And he says, "Well, he feels like he should be paid, you know, for..." This was not, you know, it wasn't Kate Kaiser. It wasn't even a guy who worked for Kate Kaiser.
Sure.
Or because, you know, even guys like Ishka Bibble, who worked for Kate Kaiser, he didn't mind giving me wonderful telephone interview. And, you know, and guys who worked for Spike, there were only two or three that wouldn't talk to me, you know, of the dozens I got hold of. But this absolute nobody. But anyway, so 79, I guess in 78 I had an assignment from the LA Times. Again, thank you, Irv Litovsky. And I went out there and out to Sherman Oaks, right? And to interview him, and he was he didn't hold anything back from me. He told me he was writing a book. And we actually talked about it. He asked me to work on it with him. I explored with him the possibility of having somebody transcribe some tapes. He had talked the whole thing into a tape recorder. And I explored with him the possibility of having somebody transcribe the tapes. And I said, you know, I'll put together a sample chapter and a prospectus, and I'll approach a couple of publishers And he would not pay $5 an hour to have somebody transcribe a couple of tapes. So I thought, okay, I can see where this is going. And after he passed away in 1985, at which time I was working on real characters, I think I managed to be out of town when almost everybody passed. But I wrote a letter to his widow, and she wrote me back a nice letter and said if she could be of any help to let her know. And so I was invited out to the house. She allowed me to go through all of his papers and photographs and everything. And there, lo and behold, was a copy of the, I can't say manuscript, it was a transcript of the alleged biography. He had somebody, he did pay somebody, or he coerced somebody or whatever, got somebody to transcribe his tapes. And but he had flattened all the stories. He'd forgotten the punchlines or lost, you know, gotten off on a tangent while he was telling a story, as so many people would if they were just trying to tell the story of
sure.
He had, and he was a good storyteller. He had a lot of wonderful anecdotes, but he was incapable of telling these stories into a tape recorder, and, you know, it just flattened it out to nothing, really.
Well, so in all the times that I've told this story, and I've always ended it by saying, and the punchline is, there was no book. There was no book. He wouldn't tell me anything, and there was no book. But at least now I know there was a book. There was kind of a book.
There was kind of a book, or at least there was
a start of a
there
book.
There was an attempt at a book, yeah.
But, so I don't feel quite so betrayed by him now. Oh. So well, George Chandler, I forgive you.
And you were, all these years, you thought that book was buried in the Guadalupe Dunes. Or
I've been digging up there, too. Yeah, all I find is this Ten Commandments stuff.
Yeah, I've been out there. It's a fun it's a fun place, yeah.
Yeah, they're looking for the wrong stuff. You know, Bo Sabrur was shot up there. That's what they should be looking for the sets from, or Morocco. A lot of good Foreign Legion pictures made up there. That's what
Morocco was shot out there.
Yeah. So, Ten Commandments,
Yeah.
Bo Sabrur, that's what they should be looking for the sets from. Or She's a Sheik with B.B. Daniels. That was shot up there.
Mm.
Well, the reason I ask about the when Real Characters was shot, because I was positive that Real Characters was already out when we met, but it wasn't.
I was working on it. I had already interviewed a lot of those people. And you know what I remember also, one of those National Film Societies, it was that you had a print of something I wanted to see, and I didn't. I think it was shown during the convention, and it was it The Last Command with Emil Jannings?
I didn't have a print of that. Somebody might have shown it.
Was it either The Last Command or the Way of All Flesh? It was one of those things. I think it was The Last Command. Anyway, you had a 16 millimeter print in your hotel room, and you gave me the key, and
I remember that.
The projector, and I went up there and screened it one day while you were out doing something.
Yeah.
I just went up to your hotel room and screened it, sat there by myself, which I've never had an opportunity to see it since, you know. It seems to me it was one of those that he, one of the three films he got the Oscar for or something.
I've completely forgotten which film it was.
Yeah.
But I do remember that experience now that you mention it.
Yeah. I think it was The Last Command. It's kind of funny that here's the guy who won the very first Academy Award for Best Actor, Emil Jannings, or Jannings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a copy of his autobiography. It's in German. I also have a very good friend, Claudia Sassen, in Germany. I've never met her. She's a huge fan of Larry Seaman and is apparently working on it.
Wow. So she's the one.
Maybe we'll see that, you know, but she was a pen pal. I think she wrote to me about Laurel and Hardy years and years ago, probably 25 years ago or something. Anyway, she's been working on Larry Seaman for years and years and apparently has put together a book. And now we're email buddies. But,
I guess there's a lid for every pot. Larry Seaman is one of those guys that I've never seen anything funny about.
Yeah, I don't get him.
I have a Facebook friend who's working on something on Al St. John, too.
About
it seems
the same
slightly
category,
interesting,
yeah.
but
yeah.
I'm always glad to see people working on obscure little corners of movie history. So I'm certainly not going to throw blame at anything.
Yeah. Claudia Sassen went to Berlin at one point, I guess on a vacation or something, and she managed to get in touch with Janning's nephew, I think, and got permission to make copies of the letters that are in the archive in Berlin. And unfortunately, they're all in German, but hey, I've got copies of all of them, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, because I did have an idea to do a book and or a play about him. I absolutely love his performance in The Last Laugh. I think he's extraordinary in that. And
The Blue Angel, he was just heartbreaking. In
The Blue Angel, and of course Faust.
I wrote a chapter in my Lost Films book on The Patriot.
That's right.
The Lubitsch film.
Yeah. And where is that? Still has not surfaced. Isn't there a trailer for it?
It's with Herbert Brennan's autobiography. That's where it is.
Okay. In the Guadalupe Dunes. Yeah.
Yep.
But isn't there a trailer that I've
seen?
There
is a trailer, yeah.
I've seen that, yeah. Yeah, and that's probably, that might be all we'll ever see. But who knows? They're coming up with things that a few years ago we didn't dream still existed, right?
Every once in a while, things pop up, so, you know, you never can tell.
But here on the Kino DVD of The Last Laugh, there's all this alternative footage I never knew existed, of that film. And there's a little documentary. This wonderful stuff turns up on those things.
Yeah. We live in an incredible time in some ways because we do have access to things that, when you and I started becoming fascinated with film history, we never had access to.
No, we didn't have, and it kind of frustrates me. Back then, I had time, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I had all the time in the world. I had homework and things. But, here are all these radio shows that are available today that I would love to listen to back in the 60s were not available.
Yeah.
All these films that there's, and yet, at the same time, we're sort of in danger of losing an awful lot of it too, maybe that's why this sort of movement almost, if you will, to try to preserve it at the last opportunity, because if you don't preserve it now or do something to ensure it's, that it's going to be around.
Yeah,
it's going to disappear. I mean, and of course, so much stuff is disappearing. And Kevin Brownlow was saying at the recent Turner Classic Movies Film Festival that they were making extraordinary efforts to. They're making DVDs of and restorations and DVDs and throwing away the nitrate prints of some and the nitrate is going to hold up for 100 years.
Sure.
If it didn't, combust in a, it's, I don't quite get that. I mean, it's also the most flammable.
Yeah, but I always tell this story, and I probably told it on this podcast before, but when I was writing my book on lost films, I interviewed all these archivists from all the major archives, and I wish I could remember. I'd have to check my own book to remember the name.
I have to do that all the
time. But a woman who worked at the Library of Congress, we were talking about videotape and that how people, for some reason at this time, which was 20 years ago, thought videotape was the record of choice, that you would, transfer all your home movies onto video and then throw your home movies away.
I didn't.
And she said, if it were up to me, I would get all the videotape in the world and transfer it to nitrate film, and it would last a lot longer. And it's true.
Yeah, my parents' home movies from the 50s transferred to videotape, and I did not discard the original 8mm because it was obvious to me that it looked better.
Sure.
And, cross my fingers, it'll hold up after the videotape is long gone.
That's what I'm dealing with in this the documentary that I just finished, on the parody of Beaugest, because that's apparently what they did, is made a videotape of that film, of which they only had one 16mm print, and now nobody knows where the 16mm print is. And so it exists only as a VHS cassette, although we've done a great deal of digital cleanup on it and tried to make it as sharp as we can.
And that itself sounds like a satire on...
Yeah. It's still... We could only do so much. I mean, you can only improve so much. So, yeah, it's funny. We always seem to be taking two steps forward and three steps back and everything when it comes to film preservation of any kind. So it's just... But anyway,
it's extraordinary all the things that we have from the 20s and 30s, considering. And yet, you know, there's so much has been lost that we were talking, did we talk about Beggars on Horseback?
No.
At lunch? That's an Edward Everett Horton, a silent title, circa 1925, 26. I would love to see it. I think just a piece of it. Actually, I did just see a piece of it on YouTube. Just a little a fragment of it, you know. But even that was wonderful. It was the title. I mean, a film I'd always known and had seen stills from back in the 60s. Had never seen it. Didn't know that anything existed until, you know. But apparently the film was lost.
Well, how are you doing your research these days? And I will ask that by saying I'm really eager to read a book of yours that I have not yet read, which is about the making of The Quiet Man. So I'm curious about that because it's only an ebook, right? I mean, it exists only as an ebook, or does it?
Right. It's although actually, I am doing a.
And I'm not saying only an ebook the way you would say. Are you just directing this film?
we talked about that too at lunch. yeah, there is a print-on-demand version of it.
Oh, okay,
I'm still working out a few kinks, but I guess it's an ebook in part. Although I may do a paperback version at some point, but it's a small book.
Yeah.
I'm doing a lot of ebooks these days. That one is selling very well, but I'm trying to do ones where I have, you know, material that in this case I interviewed Maureen O'Hara. I talked to Winton C. Hawk, the cinematographer.
Yeah.
I talked to about six people who worked on that picture. This includes, you know, people at Dublin.
Sure.
Eileen Crow, who plays Mrs. Playfair.
Yeah.
I managed to talk to her on the phone one day, not long before she passed, and other people. This, of course, all started with my book on Jack McGowran, who was a stage and screen actor that may be unknown to many people, but he played Victor McLaughlin's sidekick in The Quiet Man. And that really started... all of this.
Sure.
He became best known for appearing in the plays of Samuel Beckett and Sean O'Casey, but he's in Dr. Zhivago.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Tom Jones. He's in Polanski's Cul-de-Sac, as a result of which Polanski wrote the next picture for him. That's another ebook because I interviewed Polanski, I interviewed Donald Pleasence, I interviewed Lionel Stander,
wow,
and Jack McGowran, all about the making of Cul-de-Sac.
Wow!
But so I have to do that.
I'd read
one.
That.
Yeah. But and it just came out on Blu-ray, which I haven't seen the Blu-ray version of it. But the follow-up film is The Fearless Vampire Killers, or as the original title is Dance of the Vampires. But when I was researching this book, I got hold of Polanski's secretary in London, and just by some quirk of fate, she happened to be McGowran's old girlfriend from Dublin, or one of his many, you know, lady friends, and. Concepta Fennell. Still remember her name.
Concepta.
Lovely Irish name.
Yeah.
She arranges for me at Paramount House in London a screening of Dance of the Vampires. And it's Polanski's personal print. And Roman did, I mean, I did interview Roman in Los Angeles prior to this, but he didn't have anything to do with this. This is a couple of years, this is a year later. And Concepta set up a screening of his personal print. This is long before it's even available on, in any... Eventually, it gets shown on cable or it's DVD. I don't know. It certainly isn't as memorially restored or anything. I don't know if his version is actually available on DVD. It might be.
Yeah, I don't know that it is.
But his Polanski's version, Dance of the Vampires, was released all over the world, except in the United States, where that idiot Martin Rantzhoff. he was the one who brought Sharon Tate to the table.
Yeah,
he's responsible for. See, he did do something that, he ruined the picture. According to Polanski, Roman told me that he ruined the picture because he took out McGowan's and Polanski's voices and dubbed them for the U.S. release. And he recut the picture and, for American audiences and, he messed with the soundtrack. And I'm trying to remember if that one has the, Christoph, is it Kmita? Kmita was a friend of Polanski's from, Warsaw. They went to film school together, but anyway, he was this incredibly inventive and wonderful jazz pianist, composer, and did the score for all of Polanski's early pictures, and then died in this tragic accident in Hollywood. Apparently, he and this mutual friend of Polanski's, this Polish artist or something, they're at a party, Krzysztof Kmita and this artist friend. They're at a party and they get drunk, and Kmita's too drunk to walk home to their, I don't know, they're staying in the Hollywood Hills or something nearby, but so the friend picks him up to carry him, and he's drunk and he falls over, and Kmita hits his head on the curb or something and dies as a result of this really tragic. If you listen to these early Kmita scores, mm-hmm. and they're all over the place, but they're a very inventive and wonderful musician. But anyway,
what a random way to go.
And so Polanski lost both Sharon Tate and his, like, just practically his best friend, Kmita, just within a very short time.
Wow.
But anyway, the Polanski version is shown all over the place, and it's a huge hit, except for the version that was shown here. But getting back to my... The screening that Concepta Fennell set up at Paramount House in London. It's a screening just for an audience of one. And, I mean, if I ever felt special, it was that day. But the projectionist brought me a cup of tea. And he said, friend of Roman's, friend of everyone's. One of my favorite moments from... that book, which was really, I think, the great journalistic adventure of my life, the McGowan book, because it took me to New York and to London and to Dublin to do the research and almost to Paris to meet Samuel Beckett. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Oh.
And I'm a huge aficionado of Beckett's work. But, I just interviews with Peter O'Toole and Roman Polanski and Cyril Cusack and... Michael McLeamore, the doyen of Irish theater, cohort of Orson Welles, and so many others, Siobhan McKenna, and Joseph Papp, and some guy named John Lennon, and so many other people. McGowan worked on How I Won the War with John Lennon, and so I called Apple in New York, and I was going to be in New York. It was kind of the George Marshall story. Call tomorrow. Call next week. But one day I call and you know, he's sleeping, and the next day he's sleeping, and the next day they go and they either he's awake from his nap or whatever. But I get John Lennon on the phone for 20 or 30 minutes.
Wow.
And, you know, somebody, a friend of mine said to me, how did you, you know, I feel like impossible. I was never a Beatle. I was never a huge Beatle fan.
Oh, boy, I was. So I envy you very much for that.
Yeah, you know, I never met him, you know, but this was, he wasn't giving interviews in 1975. He was just about to go underground, you know, that whole period.
Man, there's so much more to talk to you about. I feel bad that we've gone through so much time, and there's so we'll just have to do part two.
We'll fix it in post.
We'll fix it in post. So we'll get together for the second one much sooner than it took to do the first one.
Okay.
Jordan, this has been a great pleasure for me. It's been great fun, so I appreciate it.
Frank, it's been great fun talking to you, and I'm sorry it's taken us so long to get together, and I look forward to part two.
We'll do it again.
Well, I trust that you enjoyed that talk with Jordan Young, and like I say on so many of these things, we're going to have him back, because I got to the end of that interview and realized just how many great parts of his career we just haven't even touched on yet. So I didn't want to tire him out and make him faint from exhaustion, so we just cut it off there, and we will pick it up at another time, because he's got lots more great stories to tell. I said up front that I appreciate everybody who does the reviews, and that's a great non-financial way to support the podcast. But, of course, there are financial ways to support the podcast. One of them, you can just make a donation. You just go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and there is a PayPal banner that just says donate, and you can hit and give any amount that you choose, from a dollar to $1 million. And I must say, I strongly urge you to give $1 million if you can. But if you can't, and I understand that at least some of my listeners are unable to give me $1 million. So if you can't, then $1, $5, $20, whatever you feel comfortable with, and whatever you feel that you would like to help out this podcast. Because this is not a money-making proposition, not by any means. And the way it's going, it's not going to be a money-making proposition for, I would say, the foreseeable 80 years, maybe 78 years, if I'm lucky. So any help you can offer is highly appreciated. Now, if you want to get something more tangible for your buck, I urge you to go to the individual pages on the website and order my books and order my videos. I will autograph the books if I have copies of them, and you can tell which ones I have copies of because there are prices on them. And if there's just an Amazon link, I don't have copies, so you will just have to order through there, but I'll at least get a kickback. And I also list books and videos related to each and every one of my guests, and so you can buy the books that they've written and the videos that they've been a part of. And if you click through the Amazon links, then I will get a little bit of kickback from Amazon, and that would be a consummation devoutly to be wished. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire, for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit both of them. And you can also contact James through them and tell him what a grand job he did. Also want to thank, of course, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music, Fore and Aft. And Rob is also the composer of most of the music in my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, which I continue to hope will be out any moment. This is a long, sad story, and I will not bore you with it at this point. But you can, if you have not listened to the special episode I did, in which I simply talk about how that documentary came to be, and I give you a little bit of the troubles in the production of this thing. It's been much harder than it should have been, and it's been very frustrating and even maddening, and, but it's almost done now, so, all's well that ends well, right? And I hope that you will enjoy that when it comes out, and you will enjoy Rob Clearfield's lovely music. And I must say, my great friend Michael Mortilla also contributed some music to that. And Michael wrote the musical score and played the piano score to the actual Beaugest parody that the documentary is about, and that is also on the disc as a bonus feature. So you'll get to be some of the first people since 1940 to see this film, and then see the documentary about how it came to be, and I hope that you will enjoy them both. It's been a real dream project for me in many ways, and no matter what the frustrations, it's still something I'm so pleased to be a part of and so proud to have produced, and I hope that you'll enjoy it as much as I've enjoyed it, or at least as much as I will enjoy it once this nightmare is over. So, that wraps it up for another episode, and we will see you again next week. I have a great guest coming up next week. Up until then, don't you worry, we're going to fix it in post.